Good morning and welcome to a very special edition of the Outside the Box podcast, where this morning Benji and I are joined by James Pearce, the Liverpool correspondent for The Athletic. James obviously he's worked at the Liverpool Echo, he's recently joined The Athletic and is one of the most reliable journalists, reliable sources for Liverpool news. So James, my first question to you is about something that recently has happened, has devastated a lot of Liverpool fans given our recent defensive problems in terms of Virgil van Dijk's injury as well, and it's the injury to Joe Gomez that happened yesterday on England duty. We're recording at 11:15 on a Thursday morning, and you said an announcement's expected later today. But as far as you know at the moment, is there anything you can tell us about the nature of the injury and potentially how long it might be?
Yeah, well, my understanding at the moment is that, as we're chatting now, they're waiting for scan results on Joe Gomez's knee. So I think it's fair to say there's a fairly large amount of concern surrounding it, because I think as Gareth Southgate said in his press conference yesterday, you know, he said that Joe Gomez was in a huge amount of discomfort and pain on the training field when it happened. No one was near him. His leg kind of buckled and he went down. So I think when anything like that happens, you automatically fear the worst. And I think, you know, obviously we're just waiting to discover the full extent of the damage and how long he'll be out. But, you know, the reality is, in Liverpool's situation, any kind of period on the sidelines is going to hurt them badly, because, of course, with Virgil van Dijk facing a battle to play again this season, Fabinho still trying to overcome a hamstring problem. And then obviously you've got Joel Matip has had fitness problems of his own as well. It certainly gives Jurgen Klopp a massive headache.
Absolutely, and yeah, it's been ongoing issues with Joel Matip and Joe Gomez. As a Liverpool fan, I'm a fan of both players, but sometimes they just can't be relied upon in terms of their injury records. My next question's about our younger centre-backs. Obviously, we saw Nathaniel Phillips give a man-of-the-match display against West Ham. Reece Williams, obviously not conceding a goal yet in the Champions League, is also a really big achievement. What are your thoughts on our younger centre-backs, and who do you think could step up with this added difficulty?
Yeah, well, I think certainly at the front of the queue amongst those kind of fringe centre-backs is Reece Williams, because, he's absolutely excelled since being given his opportunity on the back of Van Dijk's injury. I think he was a player that I've long since had, you know, really high hopes for. He was a key member of the Liverpool under-18s team that won the FA Youth Cup just over 2 years ago, went out on loan. It was a strange kind of loan, really, because Liverpool don't traditionally send their most gifted young players into non-league football. But there was a feeling that, as good as he was technically, they just wanted him to toughen up by playing men's football, and that certainly did the job. So I think we'll certainly be seeing a lot more of Reece Williams. I think Nat Phillips, he'll also get chances. I think obviously he's not registered to play in the Champions League, which kind of will limit his game time, but I think we'll certainly see him in the Premier League. Certainly, I think games like the one against West Ham probably suited Nat Phillips, because he's strong, he's powerful, he's good in the air. I think he's probably better suited to play in teams who go with that kind of threat and attack rather than a really pacey front line. And then Billy Cometio, who people won't have seen a huge amount of him so far, but he was a young player that really endeared himself to Klopp in pre-season, and the senior players, they were blown away by how good he was in Austria in the training camp. And it was we would have seen Cometio play for Liverpool before now, but for injury problems of his own. But he made his comeback in the 23s a few days ago, and so he's another one that will be knocking on the door as well.
So yeah, Liverpool have been unlucky and marred by injuries recently, especially in the centre back position. Who would you see them realistically going for in January? Do you think a Dio Upamecano transfer is on the cards, or is that unrealistic at this stage?
I mean, it's going to be really interesting to see how they do handle it, because certainly my information on the back of what happened with Van Dijk was it was a case of, it's too soon to say. We don't know whether we'll be entering the market in January. There was the usual caveats of, it's not a great time to go and buy. You end up pretty much paying a premium, I think, in January to try and wrestle someone, really decent away from a club. But you know, you just wonder if Gomez is facing a long absence, then you know, personally, I think that that turns kind of maybe having to go into the market in January into making it an absolute necessity. You know, there's a few names that have been talked about. I think you know, you mentioned up Meccano there. He's certainly on the radar. I think the issue there would be, I'm pretty sure his release clause doesn't actually come into effect until next summer. So he may well fall into that category of difficult to get away mid-season. And then you've got players like Kabak at Schalke. You know, I know he's been looked at. Of course, Ben White at Brighton. You know, I think the only thing with Ben White is, again, the kind of the premium on homegrown talent that you end up having to pay to try and get someone like that on board, because you know, I think Leeds were willing to pay, I think it was nearly 28-30 million for him in the summer, and Brighton wouldn't sell at that price. And you just think, well, surely for that kind of money, Liverpool would be able to get better value in one of the other European leagues. So, myself and Tom Warville, who's you know, absolutely brilliant with the data for The Athletic, we did a joint piece recently, kind of you know, partly based on my information in terms of who Liverpool were looking at, and also him kind of crunching the numbers and looking at who might, you know, fit the bill. So, you know, those were some of the names that were thrown up in that piece.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And my next question is about the summer signing. It's obviously Thiago Alcantara being a really high profile signing for the club, potentially the biggest signing I've seen in terms of his pedigree as a Liverpool fan in my lifetime. Obviously, we brought in Diogo Jota and Kostas Tsimikas as well. Lots of rumours kind of swirled around about Thiago's signing. There was rumours that the owners were unhappy with his age and the fact he didn't fit the kind of under 25 year old profile that Liverpool generally try and sign. Can you give us any kind of inside stories on the nature of the Thiago transfer? Obviously, because there are a lot of rumours about it. There were apparently a few issues behind the scenes as well before it happened. Obviously, it did get over the line. And were there potentially any other signings considered this summer that didn't come through?
I mean, I think the first thing to say on that is it was an incredibly difficult summer for Liverpool, like it was for a lot of top clubs, trying to address what they needed to address in the transfer window, whilst being hampered by the financial realities of coronavirus. Because, you know, I got a bit tired on social media over the summer trying to, like, you know, people just didn't seem to understand that, you know, yes, Liverpool had just won the Premier League title, but this idea that there was, like, you know, sack loads of cash just sitting around waiting to be spent just didn't stack up with the reality of having a wage bill that's, what, £325 million a year, and, you know, players didn't have wage cuts, you know, during the shutdown. And, you know, you speak to people in senior positions at Liverpool and they'll tell you that, you know, the shortfall, you know, revenues-wise, you know, has now gone past the £100 million mark. So it was, you know, I think that was why, where traditionally we've been used to Klopp getting his business done early, this time around, it was always going to drag on, because I think, certainly from a financial viewpoint, you know, Liverpool wanted certainty about how revenues were going to come back. They didn't really know, you know, early on in the summer when they were being linked with Thiago, you know, they didn't even know things like how much they have to repay to the TV companies, you know, with the rebate. I think that was one of the reasons why Thiago dragged on so long. And you're right, it was completely out of keeping with Liverpool's traditional way of, you know, investing in younger players. And, you know, Klopp, you know, doesn't tend to buy the finished article. You know, I don't think, you know, you could probably argue maybe Alisson and Van Dijk fitted that bill, but neither even Alisson or Van Dijk had the kind of CV in terms of trophies that that Thiago had. So I think clearly from an early on, Liverpool had made it very clear they wanted Thiago. I think the reason it took so long was because they had to make it work financially. And I think also the longer it went on, because Klopp had sold Liverpool so well to Thiago, he only wanted Liverpool. So that, over time, that really strengthened Liverpool's bargaining position as well, because, you know, I think Bayern did their best to try and provoke a bit of an auction to try and, you know, to try and get the fee up for him. But the reality was it never really got off the ground, because I think any other club that spoke to Thiago's representatives were told, no, he wants to go and play for Klopp. He wants to join Liverpool. So And so I think, you know, you have to give Michael Edwards a lot of credit because, you know, there was such a clamour outside. You know, what are they waiting for? You know, we're going to miss out on him. And, you know, they're very good. You know, like Michael Edwards, Mike Gordon and Klopp, like ignoring all the noise outside and just sticking to their guns. And, you know, I think in the end, you know, they were proved right. You know, when you get someone of Thiago's calibre for, what was it, I think, 20 million guaranteed, rising to 25 million. And, you know, going back to my earlier point about the finances being so key, you know, they only had to pay 5 million up front.
Yeah, that Thiago, was really good.
Which, you know, and similar in a way to Jota, because I think they only paid something like 4.5 million initially for Jota. And even that was offset by selling Kajana Hoover to Wolves. So, you know, Liverpool did have to kind of wheel and deal to address a couple of key areas in the squad this summer. I know people will say, you know, they should have signed a centre back. You know, should they have upgraded the, you know, Adrian? But you know, I still think, you know, without using the benefit of hindsight with what's happened with the injuries, I think they addressed the real key areas. And you know, I suppose in terms of players that got away, I suppose, you know, I think you'd have to say so far it looks like it's worked out for the best. But you know, Ismael Sarr at Watford was someone that Liverpool were very much interested in. He was, to my knowledge, the kind of the, you know, at the top of their list of attacking targets initially. But you know, Watford's financial demands were so great that they decided to focus on Jota instead.
Yeah. So you mentioned Diogo Jota, and he's made a great start to his Liverpool career. It seemed he would be more of a long-term replacement for Sadio Mane. But recently, I'd say that Bobby Firmino's performances on the pitch have been less impactful, and he has dropped off compared to the level of Mane and Salah. But do you think there's a chance Firmino could be on the bench for Jota long-term and he could be replaced?
Yeah, I think it's certainly, you know, it's certainly now a serious discussion. I mean, I was really surprised that Klopp played all four of them at the Etihad last weekend, because I thought it would be too bold, bordering on reckless, to play all four away in a fixture like that. I mean, it was probably a mixed bag in the end, because I thought for half an hour Liverpool threatened to blow City away, and City looked genuinely shocked by the way Liverpool set up. But I think once City then got to grips with the formation, you know, Liverpool then were probably fortunate not to lose the game, especially when, you know, they lost their way in the second half. So, yeah, I think the biggest compliment you can pay Jota is he's done so well since he's come in, that he's gone from being regarded as like high caliber backup to actually, how can you possibly leave this fella out of a big game? Which I don't think you can on form at the moment. And, you know, I really like Firmino. And, you know, I think probably in football these days, there's, you know, a bit of an alarming tendency to immediately just write people off after a bit of a barren spell. And I've got no doubt that Firmino will still have a huge role to play for Liverpool. But, you know, I don't think he can be regarded as an automatic first pick now. And not just because of his goal return, because I don't think you could ever judge Firmino just on goals, because he gives so much else. He's such an unselfish team player. But I just think even the other elements of his game have suffered over, you know, probably the course of 2020. And it's probably not a big surprise, because, you know, he's played way more minutes than anyone under Klopp, you know, and with his international commitments thrown in and all the travelling, you know, he very rarely gets any kind of a proper break, Firmino. So, you know, he probably won't see it that way at the moment, because he probably does feel threatened by Jota's kind of, you know, his amazing impact. But it might even help Firmino in the long run as well, if it, you know, just easing the burden on him a bit.
And yeah, it's certainly a healthy competition as a Liverpool fan's perspective. You know, we've got not only three really quality players up front, now we've got this fourth in Diogo Jota, and I'm personally really excited to see how they might be rotated, how they might be played together this season. My next question's about Jurgen Klopp and the players. Obviously, within your role as a highly respected Liverpool journalist, you've met Jurgen Klopp on a number of occasions. You've met Liverpool players. Obviously, you've been photographed with Trent Alexander-Arnold as an example. Are they similar or potentially different to their media personas? And yeah, can you sort of tell us, what are they like sort of off camera? I think a lot of Liverpool fans would love to know.
Yeah, well, I think certainly with Klopp, you know, I think the reason why he is so revered and admired by everyone he works with is what you see is what you get with him. He's just a very genuine, authentic guy. And I think that shines through when you speak, not just to, you know, I did a big article last week on The Athletic in terms of what it's like to play for Klopp. Right from, like, you know, the tactical side of things in terms of how he gets his messages across to the man management and, you know, the way that Klopp is, you know, players just really, really appreciate, you know, his honesty. I think, you know, when Aldam described Klopp as, like, you know, he said he's like your mate, but not your best mate, because, you know, he has to obviously keep a degree of distance. But he also massively cares. You know, some managers are quite cold. But, you know, when I interviewed Klopp last season, I remember him saying that, you know, how can I possibly get the best out of everyone I work with unless I know everything that's going on in their lives? You know, if players have got problems in their personal life, I need to know about it, because then I can help them, and then that will hopefully have a positive impact. And so, yeah, I've never met anyone quite like Jurgen Klopp. You know, you do meet a lot of people in football who have got one face for the cameras and one face when the cameras are switched off. But that's not the case with Klopp. You know, it's not just a front he puts on. It's not a PR thing. You know, you only have to look back to, you know, the stories about when he first came in, when he, you know, made every member of staff at Melwood walk through the room and told the players, you know, I expect you to know the names of every single person here because they're all important. We're all in this together. And that's always been his attitude. And then that, his personality is so huge that it kind of radiates through the club. And I think in terms of the players, I think the knock-on effect of that is that you don't, I don't, from all my dealings with the current team, I don't really sense any massive egos. I don't sense any arrogance, or, because I just don't think, it's not an environment that kind of allows that kind of thing to go on. I just think if anyone did turn up with that kind of attitude, it would be quickly knocked out of them when you've got two, you know, model professionals of the caliber of Jordan Henderson and James Milner, who, you know, essentially run the dressing room. So I can honestly say that you know, both manager and players, it's very much what you see is what you get.
Yeah. So in the 17-18 Liverpool side, they were more associated with a heavy metal attacking style of play, and ever since then they've become more efficient and pragmatic in play. Would you say the change in style, like, directly correlates with the departure of Zeljko Buvac in 2018?
I think that's a factor. Yeah, I wouldn't say it's the only one. I think certainly in the months leading up to that, probably over the course of that season before Buvac went, there was a sense of him becoming less influential. And of course, during that time before he went to Holland for a few months, you know, Pep Linders was becoming more influential in terms of his input. So I think that's a factor. But I also think, Klopp evolved his style as well, not just based on the staff around him, but also as he got to grips more with English football. And I think he just realised that actually probably this way of playing probably isn't sustainable if you're going to win titles in England, just because of the schedule, the physical demands of it, you know, the energy required, you know, especially when they had, you know, injuries racking up. So I think he just took a step back and assessed it all and thought, well, actually, you know, why are we, you know, absolutely putting our foot to the floor when we're 3-0 up against Southampton? Why are we not just going, well, actually, we're 3-0 up against Southampton, we'll actually ease off a bit here? And, you know, I think probably the game when I think back to when it really stuck out for me was, I think it was Southampton, when I think it might have been even Shaqiri's debut, or certainly very early on in Shaqiri at Liverpool, when I think he played Shaqiri as one of the three in midfield, and I think Liverpool were either 2 or 3-0 up at the time, and then he actually took Shaqiri off despite the fact Shaqiri had created a couple of goals, and I think he might have stuck on James Milner. And at the time, you just thought it's a very un-Klopp like thing to do, because, you know, I just assumed Liverpool would just go foot to the floor and probably win 5-2 or 6-2, because that was just seemed to be the Klopp way. But they didn't. They just you know, actually took a step back and just controlled the game. And I think that was key to, you know, certainly to get 97 points and to go so close the season before last, and then obviously to get 99 and win it last season. You know, I think we just saw Liverpool become a lot more streetwise in terms of conserving energy at times and just being able to grind out wins rather than feeling like they always had to, like, put on some, like, tremendous show that involved, you know, every player running 15 kilometres.
Yeah, absolutely. I remember it was pretty well summed up with the game against Roma when we were 5-0 up and then conceded two goals. And a pundit said, I can't remember which pundit actually, but he said only Liverpool could be 5-0 up and still be nervous that they might go out in the second leg. So my next question is a very broad one, to be honest. Obviously, Jurgen Klopp celebrated his 5-year anniversary as Liverpool manager a couple of weeks ago. And Liverpool FC released on their YouTube channel, their social media, basically the key moments under Jurgen Klopp's tenure. I want to ask you what you personally think were perhaps the what would you say is the biggest moment in terms of what set Liverpool on a path to success. A lot of people say obviously it was the 2-2 against West Brom where Jurgen Klopp made the players address the fans. A lot of people say we kind of got that mentality back in Europe with the 4-3 over Borussia Dortmund. So do you have a particular moment where you thought this is where it's come together, this is where we're on the path to success?
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't say there's necessarily one particular moment. I think there was just lots of kind of signposts along the way that kind of said to you, this is now a very different Liverpool. And you're right, I think, you know, West Brom, you know, that still intrigues me now, because I remember, you know, like, I was still working at the Echo then, and, like, you know, the Evertonians in our office, you know, like, mocking on that Monday morning, like, their attitude was, you know, how pathetic to be celebrating, you know, a home draw against West Brom that was scrambled in the last few seconds. I think Origi scored late on, and you're trying to explain, well, no, it's not a celebration of a draw home to West Brom. It's Klopp saying to the fans, look, that is what we can do if we all stick together, you know, because obviously there'd been the thing with fans leaving early. And so I think, yeah, that was definitely significant in terms of rebuilding Fortress Anfield, because I do think Klopp was quite underwhelmed by Anfield when he first arrived, because I think, you know, he described himself, didn't he, as a, you know, a football romantic and all the rest of it. And I think he just thought, I'm coming to this amazing cathedral of football. And then, you know, and then suddenly within, you know, he thinks, well, hang on a minute, why are people getting off with 10 minutes to go when we're 2-1 down? It's just, to him, it was just kind of mind-boggling. So that was definitely key. I mean, definitely the run to the Europa League final. I know it kind of gets forgotten now because of obviously Liverpool excelling in the Champions League. But, you know, that was an amazing run to the final of the Europa League, you know, against all expectations. Because that was Klopp doing it with a squad that had pretty much been written off under Rodgers as, you know, not being fit for purpose, really. And then to get that out of them. So I think that run just changed the whole kind of mindset. And, you know, I even, one game that I always think gets overlooked quite a lot is the 5-4 at Norwich when Klopp had his glasses broken in the bundle on the pitch. You know,
yeah,
when Lallana scored
in, winner, yeah.
What was it, the 96th or 97th minute or something crazy. And again, I just think for a group of players who had quite a lot of setbacks, you know, and again, people will go, well, you know, Liverpool should be beating Norwich, but it was more the manner of it. Of rather than when you concede so late, thinking, oh shit, here we go again. It was actually, well, you know, roll your sleeves up, go down the other end and get another one. So, you know, I still think probably the most, you know, then you've got the recruitment side of things. I always think recruitment-wise, you know, the signing of Sadio Mane is absolutely huge in the context of Liverpool's rise under Klopp, because he was the first main signing of Klopp's tenure. And, you know, I think without him, Liverpool don't get back in the Champions League the following season. And if they don't get back in the Champions League the following season, you know, do they realistically attract Mo Salah? I'm not sure. And then, of course, then that has a big knock-on effect in terms of everything that follows. So, you know, and then, you know, obviously further down that road, you know, the arrivals of course, of Van Dijk and Alisson just took it to the next level. And then, you know, and I think probably Liverpool don't win the Premier League unless without winning the Champions League in Madrid, because I just think that was such a big step as well, to actually go from being the nearly men to winning the biggest trophy you can get your hands on. So yeah, I think, you know, the amazing thing under Klopp is that it hasn't always been plain sailing, but I think right from the outset that there were signs of like amazing progress, and you could see. I think you could always see what he was trying to achieve, and now it's evolved into something incredible.
Well, I was hoping we'd follow in your footsteps as an Arsenal fan, but then we lost 3-0 to Villa. So Salah is 28, Firmino's 29, Mane is 28. They're at the peak of their powers, I say, but we saw the long-term thinking from Michael Edwards after Liverpool signed Jota this summer. But are there any other ideas for when the front three leave the club eventually?
Yeah, I mean, it's quite often a topic of conversation amongst Liverpool fans. And I think there's a danger of almost like trying to look too far into the future, because I think you only have to look at Salah's form over, to be honest, his form full stop since he's been a Liverpool player, but especially the way in which he started this season. I was getting bombarded earlier on in the year with people that, we've got to sell Salah, bring in Jadon Sancho. And it's like, in Salah, Liverpool have got someone who's absolutely world class and at the peak of their powers. I wouldn't swap him for anyone. And the same with like Mane now. So I think the biggest challenge for Klopp is going to be judging when they're on the other side, when they are starting to go down. And that is something is going to be a bit of a unique challenge for him, because I don't feel as if he's ever faced that in his career before, because of course at Dortmund he was almost having to continually evolve because he was used to his best players being cherry picked. Whilst I think he's now put Liverpool in a position where I think any player now regards leaving Liverpool as a step down, because I don't think. Why would you, a few years ago it would have seemed unthinkable to say it, but now I think, well, if you're at Liverpool, why would you leave Liverpool for Barcelona, or why would you leave Liverpool for Real Madrid? It just, to me, it wouldn't make sense. There will be a time, obviously, when Mane and Salah and Firmino aren't as productive, and then you've obviously got the conundrum there of, do you sell them at a time when their value is still high, or do you, almost like change their role slightly and keep hold of them? That's still a conversation for probably 2 years' time, just because I think, players look after themselves so well these days that I don't see any signs in either of them that they're suddenly like, reach their peak and they're going down the other side. But, that, and for someone who's very close to his players, when the time comes, that is going to be difficult for Klopp, because he's saying goodbye and putting someone towards the door that's done a huge amount for you. It isn't going to be easy, but they're the kind of big, tough, ruthless decisions he's going to have to make, because he's committed to Liverpool until 2024, which realistically that means. Having already built one great team at Liverpool, he's going to have to start building another one.
Yeah, and talking of that date, 2024, it's a date that I think a lot of Liverpool fans, including myself, don't really want to think about, because that is the time that Jurgen Klopp will leave Liverpool unless he decides to sign a contract. Obviously, he's already signed a contract, so that does seem unlikely. I just wanted to know your thoughts on, because again, this is a divisive issue amongst Liverpool fans. Who would be your pick to replace Jurgen Klopp right now? And who do you potentially think Liverpool might go for? Of course, there's always talk of Steven Gerrard, and he's actually had a great start with Rangers this season. I'm very much a fan of the idea of kind of re-establishing some form of boot room and potentially giving Pep Linders the promotion. So what direction could you potentially see Liverpool going in?
Personally, I love the idea of Steven Gerrard being Klopp's successor. I think for a number of different reasons. It almost feels like it's his destiny to manage Liverpool one day anyway. And, you know, I just think about what Anfield would be like on the, you know, the first game when Steven Gerrard was to take charge. And, you know, and of course, you know, what an unbelievable story it would be for that to happen. But I just think in football, as we know, things can change so fast. And, you know, and names that we talk about now wouldn't necessarily be relevant in 4 years' time when we think the job will come up. And, it is still possible that Klopp could turn around in 2 years' time and then commit for another two to 2026. I think I'd be surprised. I think he seems to have kind of set his stall out in terms of, you know, this, you know, that is my commitment to Liverpool. But, you know, I think a lot will depend on his energy and enthusiasm, because it is such a draining job. And I think, you know, he's always as well made it clear, Klopp, he doesn't want to be one of these managers that's, you know, on the touchline into his 70s. And, you know, I think he'd made a promise to his wife that he'd be, you know, retired by the age of 60. And I think after Liverpool, I could only really realistically see Klopp probably managing the German national team. The biggest compliment you can pay Steven Gerrard is, I think, you know, slowly but surely, he's kind of completely kind of silencing those who questioned whether he had the credentials in terms of management. And I know there's obviously a big difference between managing in the SPL and managing in the Premier League and, you know, in the latter stages of the Champions League, which is what he'd be doing at Liverpool. But, you know, he has done a really, really good job there. And, you know, I think he's proven beyond doubt that he's deadly serious about being a manager. You know, there's a big temptation for elite players reaching the end of their careers now not to go down that route, because I think, you know, you only have to listen to Jamie Carragher talk on Sky about, you know, why would I want all that hassle? Mm. And, you know, in an industry where now there's so little job security. So, you know, Steven Gerrard, massively passionate about that. We all know that the Liverpool job, you know, is his target. It's going to be interesting. I mean, you're right to mention Pep Linders. I think he would have to be part of the conversation just because, you know, he has been such a big part of what Klopp has achieved at Liverpool. You know, Pep Linders is such a highly respected coach and the players love working with him. Of course, being a great coach doesn't necessarily make you a great manager. You know, I think he would be in the mix. And then, you know, Liverpool are bound to look further afield as well. That, you know, you just wonder whether, you know, someone like Julian Nagelsmann, you know, his stock has been pretty high, hasn't it, in the last year or two? You know, yeah. Will he still be kind of flavour of the month in a few years' time? It's very difficult because it is just, you know, because I also think there's absolutely zero chance, of course, that the job comes up before the summer of 2024. It's just so much can change between now and then.
Yeah, it's obviously scary, the concept of a club legend returning, because you want them to build on their legacy that they left. So, when I look at Lampard at Chelsea, I see there's an uncertainty, and you wouldn't want him to mess the job up, because he obviously is arguably Chelsea's greatest ever player. But my next question in regards Project Big Picture. So obviously it's no secret that recently the Manchester United and Liverpool owners collaborated together to try and change the format of English football. And that became known as Project Big Picture. This was overwhelmingly rejected by the other teams. But after that, it was reported that the two teams were in negotiations to join a European Super League. Do you think this was a move to strong-arm the other Premier League teams into giving them what they want? And do you think FSG will eventually get their way and there will be some sort of reform?
Yeah, I mean, I think certainly, from my understanding, obviously the Liverpool's part they played in drawing up the plans for Project Big Picture was certainly real. You know, there's been no denials of that. I think the European Super League stuff, you know, I was told, you know, almost, you know, wasn't, there didn't seem to be the same degree of kind of credence, I think, to those reports. You know, certainly Liverpool will, you know, distance themselves from those suggestions where they didn't with Project Big Picture. I think, you know, it's been I found it quite distasteful that, you know, some of the details of Project Big Picture, with the idea that, you know, the big six could just ride roughshod over the wishes of everyone else in the Premier League. I think, I didn't like that. And I thought the shame was that some elements of the proposals actually made a lot of sense, especially the financial help to clubs a bit further down. But unfortunately, all of the good stuff got lost amidst, you know, all the spotlight being on the controversial elements of it. So, you know, I think there does have to be some changes brought in, but not as Liverpool were trying to put into place there. And I just think not just for FSG, but for, you know, Manchester United, you know, the other elite clubs as well, you need to be careful what you wish for, because, you know, the reason why the Premier League is so loved all around the world and why, you know, it has such, you know, there is such value attached to owning one of these clubs is because it's competitive. That, you know, and if you go down a route of just making, you know, more and more money for the top clubs and making the gulf between the haves and the have-nots even greater, then you actually ruin the product. And if you ruin the product, less people watch it, and you actually end up generating less money. So I just think sometimes in the rush to like fill pockets with money, they just need to take a step back. And the same principle applies to the European Super League. Like, I don't know a single fan who wants a European Super League. You know, it might make sense to people, to accountants who are going, well, hang on a minute, no, if you were to play Barcelona six times or eight times, you know, eight times a year or whatever, you know, imagine them. It's like, well, the whole point is, the reason why those games when they come along are so special is because they don't happen all the time. So, I think, you know, I was glad that Project Big Picture, you know, got dismissed in the format in which it was presented. But I do think there does need to be some changes brought in. But, not at the cost of putting the whole future in the Premier League in the hands of, you know, five or six clubs, because I think that would be wrong. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. And my next question is more, obviously we've talked about the highlights, we've talked about the really special points in Jurgen Klopp's reign, but obviously the first half of the decade, really before Jurgen Klopp came in, was a lot more difficult for Liverpool. Can you tell us a bit about your thoughts on the likes of Roy Hodgson, Kenny Dalglish's return, and Brendan Rodgers, and why it potentially went wrong for those three managers?
Yeah, well, I think again, you've got to put it in the context of where Liverpool was at as a club in the first half of the decade, because, you know, frankly, it was an absolute mess. When I think, you know, that was around the time when I started writing about Liverpool on a daily basis, and, you know, that you almost, you know, my actual way into writing about Liverpool full time when I was at the Echo was because there was so much going on in terms of the internal rows and infighting and boardroom spats that you almost needed someone to cover the politics and someone to cover the football. So, you know, when you think that it was only just over 10 years ago that Liverpool was, you know, taken to the brink of administration, and, you know, the only reason that Roy Hodgson was anywhere near the Liverpool job was because the idea was they just needed a safe pair of hands to get the club through the sale process, someone who wouldn't rock the boat, someone who wouldn't moan about the fact they had very little money to spend on players. It was painful covering the club during those 6 months of Hodgson's reign, because, you know, of course he was brought in to try and steady the ship and almost capsize the ship with just, you know, how badly Liverpool performed, and, you know, and obviously what little money there was to strengthen the squad was wasted on substandard talent. And of course, you know, you had things where you had Christian Perslow, thinking he'd pulled off the coup of the century signing Joe Cole, yet, you know, what a terrible deal that was for Liverpool. And then, you know, of course the takeover was huge in terms of just lifting Liverpool away from the brink, and obviously the appointment of Kenny Dalglish injected some much needed positivity. And that was a special time to cover the club when, you know, the return of an icon to the managerial position in Kenny. And of course he had that initial impact to the point where I think, you know, FSG didn't their idea was always just for him to keep it going to the end of the season, that they didn't envisage that he would have such a positive impact to the point where they had no choice but to really give it to him permanently. And then, of course, I think the decision to sack him certainly triggered a mixed reaction in 2012. But I think it was more because FSG knew that, despite winning the League Cup and getting to the FA Cup final, that in terms of turning the club around financially, they had to get Liverpool back in the Champions League. And they'd thrown a fair amount of money at it over the course of that year, of course, with putting money into it, plus obviously the proceeds from the sale of Torres. And it didn't happen. Liverpool were miles off the top four, so that that cost Kenny his job. And then, I think the Rodgers years, I've always got a lot of sympathy for Rodgers in terms of, I think he's sometimes unfairly judged with his time at Liverpool, because again, when he came in, you've got to put it in the context of Liverpool then. Liverpool weren't competing at the top end in the transfer market. They didn't have the money to do so. They certainly didn't have the pulling power to do so as well at that point. Rodgers was told you need to get rid of the, what the owners regarded as overpaid, underachieving, older players, and bring in young, hungry players that we want you to develop. So, of course, then we had 13-14, which was like an incredible roller coaster ride, where Liverpool came so close to winning the title, and then unfortunately, issues with recruitment cost them dear then, because they made an absolute hash of replacing Suarez, and fortunes just absolutely nosedived. So I think it there's always been a correlation between the way Liverpool are off the field now they performed on it, and I think it was only really obviously with Klopp coming in that the things were starting to look better in terms of commercially anyway. And then of course when you've got someone as charismatic as Klopp, it just takes things to the next level. And then obviously when you're qualifying for the Champions League regularly, that in turn means that you can pay out a lot more in wages and in transfer fees. So what a decade it was as a Liverpool fan, from one extreme to the other, really, from seeing Liverpool lose at home to Northampton Town in the League Cup under Hodgson, and seeing Liverpool play at home in front of 8,000 empty seats because fans didn't want to be there to be in European, World, and Premier League champions.
Yeah, it's certainly been a roller coaster of emotions. My next question is about the Liverpool midfield and three players who are sort of fighting their way to get in: Naby Keita and Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain, who have been extremely unfortunate with injuries. Curtis Jones being a really exciting youth prospect, and he's featured quite a bit at points this season. So, all three players, they're not obvious starters, but what role do you think they could play this season?
Yeah, I think, Keita is such a frustrating case, really, because, I think so many times over his, probably 2.5 years now at Liverpool, we've seen flashes of his undoubted ability. And every time, I've lost count of the number of times I've probably written a piece on terms of, this is now Naby's time. This is when things are going to really take off for him. And then, inevitably he gets another knock and is out for weeks, and you feel like he's back to square one again. So, it is a huge season for him. He desperately needs to prove that he can be relied upon. I thought it was telling, last weekend he was fit again for the game at the Etihad, yet Klopp decided to go with, the four up front rather than a three-man midfield, where, Keita would have been the most obvious one to find room for. He's got a lot to prove. And I think, Oxlade-Chamberlain has had a real, nightmare run. Broke down in pre-season with a knee problem, and initially the word was 6 to 8 weeks he'd be back, but we've gone past that now, and obviously he's going to need some time to build up his fitness, but hopefully it'll give Liverpool another option, because especially with Fabinho probably going to be having to be used at centre back increasingly this season, it does open up space in that midfield. For Keita and for Oxlade-Chamberlain when he's fit, and for Curtis Jones, that should that should give them kind of an added motivation, because I think you only have to look at the game time that Curtis Jones has got so far this season to see how much Klopp admires his development. When it became clear last season that Adam Lallana would be leaving on a free transfer, Liverpool were very clear that they didn't feel as if Lallana needed to be replaced directly, because they viewed Curtis Jones as his replacement, and he's certainly justified that faith so far.
Absolutely. And for the last 10 minutes of the show, I kind of want to talk more about your background coming into journalism and your background as a Liverpool fan. So the last couple of questions. Firstly, can you tell us some of your memories as a Liverpool fan, memories of going to Anfield, like your favourite childhood players? And then could you kind of tell us why that made you want to go into sports journalism and kind of your career? Obviously, you worked at the Echo for 14 years, is that correct? So you had a long time at Liverpool Echo. You came to the Athletic last year. So can you tell us obviously a bit about your background as a Liverpool fan and then going into journalism?
Yeah. So I grew up in a city called Bath, in the southwest of England, and my aunt was from Liverpool, so she bought me a scarf when I was about 4 or 5 years of age, and to be honest, I was born in 77, so being at primary school, football obsessed in like the mid 80s, even though we were 200 miles away from Merseyside, everyone in my class was either Liverpool or Everton. That was the shirts that everyone wore and everyone wanted for their birthdays. And so my dad wasn't really a massive football fan. It was kind of me dragging him along to games rather than vice versa. So we used to go away to when Liverpool played, down south, if they played like at Villa or Southampton away and Coventry and places like that. And then October 1990, when Liverpool played Chelsea, 1-2-0. That was my first trip to Anfield, so that was like one of my real cherished memories. And I grew up idolising Ian Rush, was my hero, and John Barnes, John Aldridge, Jan Molby, Peter Beardsley. That kind of generation of players. And I think in terms of the journalism, I my dream as a kid was to play football professionally, but it was it soon became clear, probably by the age of 11 or 12, that wasn't ever going to happen. I always thought I was fascinated by the fact that people actually got paid to write about football, and that that could actually be your job. So I just thought, how amazing is that? If you're not good enough to play football, writing about it is a definite second best. So I used to just always go and volunteer in my local newspaper in Bath, the Bath Chronicle, and I used to go to whatever non-league game they needed someone at. I'd just volunteer and go and send them 10 paragraphs afterwards. And so that was how I kind of got my foot in the door. So I started working in Bath in 2000. I spent 5 years covering Bath City and Chippenham Town. And although it's a world away from covering Liverpool, it was brilliant experience in terms of the same skills and principles are the same at whatever level. And then I went to Liverpool Uni as a student and did a degree in history from like 96 to 99. So that enabled me to go to Anfield every week for the first time in my life, which was great. And then I always wanted to move back to Liverpool. It was always the dream to try and get a job writing about Liverpool. And then I'd applied to the Echo, got a job there, moved up in the month after Istanbul in 2005. I wasn't writing about Liverpool initially. It was probably 2009, 2010 before I managed to start doing that. In the early years there, it was very much doing the jobs that no one else wanted to do. I'd go along and, interview the swimmers and the hockey players and the netball players and the gymnasts. And because obviously it was so competitive to try and write about the football. It was kind of Hicks and Gillette around that period when I started like being able to write about Liverpool permanently. And then it was a bit of a realization of a dream getting the actual senior Liverpool correspondence job there in just after Kenny Dalglish had come back as manager, actually in early 2011. Kind of eight and a half years as a Liverpool reporter before joining the Athletic. Certainly no regrets about making the move.
So something we always ask at the end of a show is, What advice do you have for aspiring journalists?
Yeah, I think that probably the most important thing I'd say to aspiring journalists is to write as much as you can. Get as much experience and as much practice as you can, whether that's volunteering to go and do work experience at places, whether it's contacting fan sites of whatever club you support and wanting to get your foot in the door that way. Because I just think it's so important to try and get out there and actually get to know people, because it's so competitive. Like when I think back to when I was at the Echo, we would have every work experience slot filled for like months and months. And, when a job might only come up once a year or once every 18 months, it's all about what can you do to try and set yourself apart from other people. And the reality is going the extra mile, doing the extra thing, coming in with great ideas rather than just sitting there and expecting someone to give you something to write. Actually, come in with, be real positive in terms of loads of ideas. And I also think for young journalists at the moment, the only thing that what worries me sometimes is with a lot of websites and going down the route of just it's all about generating clicks. I just think sometimes you can almost lose why you kind of got into journalism in the first place, because, I know people that essentially their shifts are spent trawling through players' social media accounts and turning Instagram posts into stories. And it's like, well, that's not journalism. No one gets into write about football to do that kind of thing. So I think it's just really important to think about, I always think about, if you were going to go for a job, you'd want some really good examples of your work to impress people. And there's nothing better than, if you can try and break a decent story or do an interview with a former player that's got a really interesting angle to it. Because I think there's nothing beats getting out and about. And actually, of course, it's easier said than done at the moment with the pandemic. But, hopefully when times return to a bit of normality, actually getting out, meeting people, that's the only real way to get your name out there. And that's the only way as well you make contacts. Is so much of journalism really, if you want to progress, is about relationships and, building that trust with people. And, the only way you can do that is by picking up the phone and actually speaking to people direct rather than, just sitting behind a keyboard all day, rewriting stories that are on other websites.
Oh, really insightful stuff, James. Thank you very much. And that brings us to the end of the show. Thank you again to James for coming on. That's really been appreciated. I've learned so much about my own club, so that's really been amazing. That brings us to the end of the show. Thank you very much. Stay safe, guys. Thank you.